You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a new biography examines the life and legacy of the late filmmaker Stanley Kubrick. We listen to a special encore of our conversation with writer David Mikix. Now, the CDC released new guidelines yesterday for how to navigate the world after you've been vaccinated. There are still some precautions vaccinated people ought to take, like avoiding medium and large gatherings, wearing masks, and practicing social distancing in public. But once you're vaccinated, the CDC says now it's safe to visit healthy, unvaccinated people from one household, indoors, and even without masks. A Wisconsin epidemiologist joins us now to understand the new safety guidelines for life after vaccination, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about these new guidelines? Have you or your loved ones been vaccinated? Have you changed your behavior at all or been wary to do so? Do you still worry about spreading the disease even after you've been vaccinated? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Amanda Simonek is an associate professor of epidemiology at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee Zilber School of Public Health and an associate editor at Dear Pandemic, a website and social media campaign where you can find science-based info on COVID-19. Amanda, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for having me today.
Well, I gave some of the very bare basics of these new CDC guidelines for life after vaccination. What to you are some of the biggest pieces of information in this release from the CDC?
Yeah, so, you know, I think you started to summarize it pretty well. The new guidelines for people who have been fully vaccinated, which means that you are 2 weeks past the second dose if you receive the Pfizer or the Moderna vaccine, or you are 2 weeks past the single dose of the Johnson & Johnson, or also referred to as Janssen vaccine, that means you're fully vaccinated. And if that's the case, CDC has just released guidelines that it is okay for you to, one, get together with other vaccinated individuals, and that it's not necessary to require wearing masks or physical distancing. And it's also okay to visit unvaccinated people without wearing masks or physical distancing. The thing you want to keep in mind if you're going to visit with unvaccinated people is that you want to make sure that they are low risk for severe COVID disease. And the reason for that is, you know, these vaccines, they're highly effective against preventing you from severe COVID-19 disease. There has been a sort of a growing evidence that these vaccines may also prevent infection in the vaccinated individual altogether. And so the likelihood that you as a vaccinated person would spread the SARS-CoV-2 virus to somebody who's unvaccinated is reduced, but it's not 100%. So, you know, if you consider someone yourself or in your household to be high risk for complications of COVID-19, then you probably wouldn't want to have a vaccinated person visit, you know, in your household. But I think this is great news, you know, for when the trials were conducted, the main outcome of interest was really symptomatic COVID-19 illness. And so these trials were aimed at understanding whether the vaccines were, you know, the vaccine efficacy for preventing COVID-19 disease and not necessarily transmission of the infection or infection overall. But there's been a growing, you know, body of evidence from sort of observational studies since the vaccines have been rolled out in different geographic areas that indicate, and I think have given CDC reason to think that it, you know, it's reasonably safe for someone who is vaccinated to be reunited with some unvaccinated family members. One of the other key considerations is that if you're someone who's been vaccinated, you know, and you want to perhaps go visit your grandchildren and your children, you really, what they're saying is that you should get together with one household at a time. You know, we're not ready for these big reunions of multiple families and households that have unvaccinated individuals, because there's still a risk of transmission among the unvaccinated individuals in those settings. And so, you know, grandparents who are vaccinated who would like to visit their grandchildren, and children could get together with just that household, not have to take some of the precautions that have been advised in the past.
That's happy news for a lot of people. What are the next steps? What are we still waiting to learn before, say, the CDC says, yeah, let's open it up to more stuff? What are the sort of the next benchmarks we're hunting for here?
Yeah, I mean, what they're recommending is that, you know, you're only sort of lifting the mask use and the physical distancing in these household setting environments. For vaccinated individuals, they're still recommending if you go out in public that you do wear a mask and you physically distance. You know, one of the reasons for that is in a place like the grocery store or another setting, you don't necessarily know if someone's high risk, you know, for COVID-19. And so you can't kind of make that assessment that it's an okay environment for you as a vaccinated individual to let go of some of those measures that actually serve to protect other people from getting infection from you should you actually be infected. And they're still recommending that we are not getting having medium to large size gatherings. We have to keep in mind that one point of the vaccine is to protect the person who's vaccinated from severe illness. The other goal that we have with a greater and greater proportion of the population getting vaccinated is that transmission will be reduced, right? And so the fact that we have indication that these vaccines may actually prevent people from getting infected altogether is great, because that means that we should see, you know, precipitous drops in the number of cases, the rate of cases in the community as the number of people who get vaccinated increases. So I do think, as the weeks, you know, proceed here and the proportion of the population that becomes vaccinated increases and the cases drop, that we probably will see some more guidance from CDC of other areas of life where we can relax some of the measures that we've been so, you know, diligently engaged in.
Talking to epidemiologist Amanda Simonek from UW-Milwaukee, associate editor at Dear Pandemic, looking at new CDC guidelines for life after vaccination and answering your related questions at 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Tom is with us in Milwaukee. Tom, hi.
Hi. I have a neighbor who's had both shots of the Moderna vaccine, and she said that she intends to keep wearing her mask when associating with other people who have been vaccinated, because she's concerned about the ability to resist particularly the South African variant. And I wondered if there's any information on that yet.
Tom, thanks for the call. Amanda.
Yeah. So, you know, the different companies that have produced the vaccines are actively, you know, evaluating what the efficacy is against different variants that are emerging. And so there is, you know, some indication that the efficacy might be lower against different variants. That's being evaluated in a few ways. You know, one is that there are studies where they take, you know, sera from individuals who've been vaccinated and evaluate the level of neutralizing antibodies essentially that get produced. And so for the Pfizer and Moderna trials, there's some indication that those levels are lower, but it doesn't mean that there's no ability to defend against that variant. And I think we should expect that these companies, number one, are in the process of developing updated versions of their vaccines or boosters. And so if we find that a certain variant is circulating at high levels and the vaccines that have been produced and administered are not effective, you would expect to hear messaging, you know, about ways that you need to go about protecting yourself once you've been vaccinated, and potential for booster vaccines to be available on the horizon. So if you are someone, you know, who you feel like even with the vaccine, you consider yourself at high risk, you know, for complications from COVID-19, and you are concerned, there certainly is no harm in continuing to wear a mask and take extra precautions when you are socializing with other people. You know, I think these guidelines are such that you know, if you want to engage in social interactions, you know, with other vaccinated people, these are CDC is, you know, recommending that that is okay.
Thanks for that call. We're looking at new COVID guidelines for vaccinated people and taking your related questions. Amanda Simonek is with us, Associate Professor of Epidemiology at UW-Milwaukee, Associate Editor at Dear Pandemic, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you want to know about the COVID vaccines, the new guidelines for the CDC for people who have received their vaccinations and hung on for a couple of weeks after that before changing their behavior? Any other questions related to the spread of the disease, the vaccination process? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with UW-Milwaukee epidemiologist Amanda Simonek about new CDC safety guidelines for vaccinated people and other COVID vaccine-related issues. You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your questions, comments, maybe experiences now that you're vaccinated. If you are, 800-642-1234 is the number. Back to your calls now. Gary is with us in Kaukauna. Gary, hi.
Yeah, I just wondered, I have a booklet that says if you want to enter school as a kindergartner, you have to have all these different vaccines. But I'm just wondering if, and that means all the kids have to have it. Maybe there's 2 or 3% that can opt out. But I'm wondering, why is 10% a benchmark for success in the vaccination program for COVID? Because it seems like a low percentage to exonerate all the people and say, everything's open up, we can go bring right back things to normal.
I gotcha, Gary. Thanks a lot. So a couple things there. The first pamphlet Gary was referring to, I assume, means the regular vaccinations, the measles, mumps, rubella, things like that. That is not applied to the COVID vaccine to get kids back into school. And I'm not sure about the 10% benchmark as being a sign of success. I don't know. Amanda, what do you think?
Yeah, I'm not sure what pamphlet he's referring to. So I'm not sure how to answer that question. You know, right now, you know, vaccine trials are ongoing for the Moderna and Pfizer vaccine in children that are 12 and over. Only the Pfizer vaccine is available currently for children as young as 16. So I am not sure if benchmarks have been set yet, because I think we're anticipating that maybe children 12 and older, the vaccine may become available in late summer, early fall for that age group. But I haven't seen those guidelines.
Thanks for the call, Gary. One benchmark we are hoping for is some kind of functional herd immunity, mainly by getting people vaccinated, some of it coming from people who have already had COVID-19. And I know it's kind of hard to tell when that's going to give an overall protection. What kind of things are you watching for, Amanda, when it comes to herd immunity? Because mainly we've vaccinated enough people to get there.
Yeah, I mean, the estimates for what proportion of the population will need to be vaccinated to achieve herd immunity sort of range between 70 to 90%. You know, as of, I think today, almost 2 million doses of COVID-19 vaccine have been administered in the state of Wisconsin, and about 600,000 of those were second doses. And so as of right now, about 19% of the Wisconsin population has received one shot, and 10.4%, I believe, have received two shots, you know, two doses. So, you know, I think, you know, with herd immunity, it's not going to be necessarily a light switch that flicks, oh, we crossed this threshold and here we are, we've arrived, you know. But I think what we can anticipate is that as the proportion of the population that gets vaccinated continues to increase, we will continue to see a decrease in cases. And, you know, I have to say, I've been on this program I think this is my eighth time. And last time I was on the program was in November or December. And our 7-day average number of cases at that time was 6,500. And now it's about 391 as of today. You know, we have seen drops in hospitalizations and deaths over the past 2 months. And so I've joked with your producers in the past that when they thanked me for being on, I say, no worries, just have me back on the program when there's good news, you know, and when things are going in the right direction. And I think, you know, that's what we're going to continue to see is as the proportion of the population that's getting vaccinated increases, you know, that should reduce transmission and as well as prevent people from having severe disease and getting hospitalized and unfortunately dying from COVID-19. So that's, you know, what we want to be looking for over the next few months. We're going to see warmer weather. We're going to be able to, you know, reunite in outdoor settings with friends and family. And as, you know, more people in your own family get vaccinated, obviously, you know, the guidelines are that you can be around them with masks or without masks and without distancing. And so, you know, I think we're heading in a positive direction.
Let's go back to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Russ is with us in Stoughton. Russ, hello.
Hi, good afternoon. I just recently, by email, got notified that my local hospital has got hold of, after weeks of not getting any vaccine, they got hold of about 500 vaccines, they estimate. So I could go this Thursday, day after tomorrow, and get a vaccine. They do not know when they'll get more. So it brings up two questions. Number one, how long should you be between shot one and shot two? And my second question is, what is the harm in getting shot one or one vaccine and then the availability of a different vaccine comes up sooner than your first one and you get the second shot of a different vaccine? Is there any harm in it?
That's a great question. So I'll start with the duration of time between doses. So for the Pfizer vaccine, the doses are supposed to be 21 days apart. For Moderna vaccine, 28 days apart. And then for the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, this is a one-dose vaccine. So you only need to worry about that first dose. I think if you get the first dose and by the time you're due for your second dose, there is not a shot vaccine available, you know, it isn't going to be detrimental to wait a little bit longer to get your second dose. It's, you know, I think that's still better than not getting that first dose, right? And what I will say is that I think we anticipate in Wisconsin that the supply of vaccine is continuing to increase. You know, these companies are producing more and more vaccine with the availability of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine coming online. You know, I think we're going to be seeing the supply moving in a good direction. And so if you have the chance to get any of these vaccines, you know, I wouldn't think too much about, will I have a second dose available? You can cross that bridge when you come to it. One of my dear pandemic colleagues, Dr. Allison Buttenheim, you know, says the best vaccine you can get is the one you can get tomorrow. And I concur with that. So I say, if you're up, you're eligible, you have a chance to get your first dose, go for it.
Russ, thanks a lot for the call. Good luck getting that sorted out this week. We're talking to Amanda Simonek, epidemiologist at UW-Milwaukee, about guidelines from the CDC for people who have had their vaccinations and other COVID-related issues. And Amanda, a key point, these guidelines allow for some loosening up for those people who've had the vaccinations and they've been through 2 weeks since getting the vaccination. The rest of us who have not yet gotten vaccinated, you know, we see the numbers getting better. Is this a time to, you know, just to start blowing off those safety precautions?
I encourage everyone who, you know, is waiting for their turn to get vaccinated to, you know, keep doing what we've been doing. The more we can reduce the transmission of this virus, the less opportunity we have for more variants to develop. Because when this virus gets transmitted to people and it replicates, that's where these changes in the virus happen. You know, it still should be a goal, you know, to try to avoid, you know, getting infected and to reduce the spread. And I think, as I said, as more people get vaccinated, and we should see a contemporary decline in the number of cases that are occurring. We are going to be able, to open up some other sectors of our lives and our social interactions. And the fact, that CDC released these guidelines for those that have been vaccinated is really a great step in that direction. So hang tight, when it's your turn to go out there and get your vaccine, do it. And, we're heading in the right direction. So keep up the good work.
And Amanda, in our last minute, just to stay on the bringing it back for some good news theme, these vaccinations, they're really effective, right? I mean, they do, as vaccines go, a pretty good job.
Yes, extremely effective in preventing severe, illness, hospitalization, and death. And, that's great news. And I think everybody in the scientific community, was just blown away at what the level of effectiveness was or efficacy in these trials.
We'll leave it there. Amanda, thanks a lot for joining us again today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Amanda Simonek, Associate Professor of Epidemiology at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee Zilber School of Public Health and an Associate Editor at Dear Pandemic. She joins us for a look at new CDC guidelines for people who have received the full course of COVID vaccines, allowing for some unmasked meetings with maybe a grandkid, for example, or their family. One household at a time, though, please, according to the CDC guidelines. Coming up, Stanley Kubrick is a giant in cinema, and a new book looks at his life and legacy, Dr. Strangelove, 2001 A Space Odyssey, and many more. We'll revisit a conversation with the author of a new Kubrick biography and learn more about how he changed the cinematic world. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. To Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. That's a little bit of Beethoven's Ninth Symphony. This piece of music featured prominently in Stanley Kubrick's 1971 film, A Clockwork Orange. For four decades, Kubrick made some of the most memorable films in movie history. Dr. Strangelove, 2001 A Space Odyssey, The Shining, and many more. Any one of those would have put a director in an important spot in movie history. The legendary filmmaker died in 1999, shortly after finishing his final film, Eyes Wide Shut. Though he's been gone for more than 20 years, his films have endured and likely will for years to come. Now he's the subject of a new biography that looks at his life and legacy. Right now, we revisit our conversation with David Mikix. He's the Moores Professor of Honors in English at the University of Houston. He's the author of several books. His latest is Stanley Kubrick, American Filmmaker. Here's our conversation from last December. Now, I think a lot of us have probably had that moment where we're watching a bad movie and thinking, I don't know anything about making movies, but I could do a better job than that. Well, cleaning up the language a little bit, Stanley Kubrick had that thought, only it was true for him. Can you talk about how he went from a photographer to a movie maker from that moment?
Indeed, yes. Kubrick had a very interesting, almost a unique career among major filmmakers. He taught himself how to make movies. As you mentioned, he was originally a still photographer. Straight out of high school, he got a job with Look magazine, one of the two major photography feature magazines in America. And he'd been a movie addict since high school, constantly skipping out on school to see double features. And friends reported that he would sit in the seats. When he got bored, he would read the newspaper and mutter, as you said, yeah, I could do better than that. So he read a few books on movie making. He borrowed some money from an uncle. And soon he made his first short newsreel about a boxer, and then his first feature.
And looking through his career, his movies were different genres. They look different. They feel different. Is there something you could say, this is a consistent theme, a consistent element that really distinguishes a Stanley Kubrick movie?
You know, Rob, that's one of the most fascinating things about Kubrick. And, you know, I had so much fun writing this book, trying to tease out the relationships among these movies, which, as you say, at first seem so different. And yet they all are very interconnected. You know, in a Kubrick movie, you have an elaborately programmed world, usually, that controls the people in it. And there's a concern with melding human behavior, you know, with turning people into, you know, into functions somehow. And, you know, so we see this in 2001 in Full Metal Jacket, in The Shining, and a number of the other movies. And I think in his final movie, Eyes Wide Shut, Kubrick attempts something different. He was, you know, a filmmaker who was concerned with marriage, although people don't often think of him in this way. He made three great movies about marriage, Barry Lyndon, The Shining, and Eyes Wide Shut. And in Eyes Wide Shut, at the end, we get a kind of a freedom, a release from these claustrophobic, horrible marriages that we see in the earlier movies. So there are themes that link these movies together, for sure.
Well, I'm going to throw a bunch of different individual titles at you as we go on, but let's start with the caller doing that. Tom is with us in Madison. Tom, hi.
Good afternoon. I'm very pleased that you mentioned Barry Lyndon, because it's an excellent adaptation of Thackeray's novel. And it's at that time, in 1975, I was in film school myself, and I told people I thought it was his greatest film to date. And I see now on the internet that there are others arguing the same thing. There were cameras from NASA that they used to film some of the candlelit scenes that are just amazing. He was such an artist.
Tom, thanks so much for that call and for getting us started. David, I got to admit, I'm about 50-50 on Stanley Kubrick films that I've seen. Mm-hmm. Barry Lyndon, one that I haven't seen. Introduce us to it a little more.
Okay, well, as Tom said, you know, it's a very elaborate and sumptuous movie. Tom mentioned the Zeiss cameras that were developed by NASA. This is what enabled Kubrick to use candlelight in the movie. He insisted that all scenes had to be naturally lit. It's a movie set in the 18th century. So, of course, you had to use candlelight. And since Kubrick demanded take after take, the art director, Ken Adam, who actually had a nervous breakdown, you know, he had to leave the movie. Ken Adam was just driven crazy by this, because with every take, the candles had to be burned down to exactly the right setting, exactly the right height. It's a very painterly movie. It's, you know, very lovely. It's very slow moving. It's sort of the antithesis of those sort of slapdash, you know, verve-filled 70s movies that we think of, including a movie like Clockwork Orange, which he had made just before. So it really anticipates the, you know, the taste for the historical romance or the historical epic that we see a few years later with all the Jane Austen adaptations, for example. But it's a very lovely movie.
We're talking to David Mikkix about his book, Stanley Kubrick, American Filmmaker. We're going to jump around the timeline here. Dr. Strangelove, and I want to give a listen to setting it up here. We're on the brink of nuclear war, and here's the character, the title character, Peter Sellers, as Dr. Strangelove, laying out maybe the upside for the generals and bureaucrats he's talking to. Here's a listen.
I would guess that a dwelling space for several hundred thousand of our people could easily be provided.
Well, I would hate to have to decide who stays up and who goes down.
Well, that would not be necessary, Mr. President. Could easily be accomplished with a computer. And the computer could be set and programmed to accept factors from youth, health, sexual fertility, intelligence, and a cross-section of necessary skills. Of course, it would be absolutely vital that our top government and military men be included. It to foster and impart the required principles of leadership and tradition.
Also, Peter Sellers as the president there, and the military leaders that he was talking about looking on. Maybe this isn't such a bad idea. David, talk about this absurd movie about the very real fear and risk of nuclear oblivion.
Yeah, it's quite a movie, and it's quite a concept. Kubrick, ever since the Berlin crisis at the beginning of the 60s, had become obsessed with the danger of nuclear war, and he even got to know one of the major theorists at the RAND Corporation, a guy named Herman Kahn, who liked to speculate about the consequences of nuclear war, and, you know, we have to take it as a practical possibility. Maybe the war will happen, and then what will we do? So all of this stuff about mega deaths and, you know, how many millions would die in a nuclear exchange, you know, all of that comes from real nuclear theorists, of course. But what Kubrick did, and this is the really radical thing about the movie, is he played this as a wild satire. You know, it's this Rabelaisian, totally extravagant vision of nuclear war. And a lot of people were taken aback by this at the time. I mean, the movie was a huge hit. But there were various reviews that said, oh, how dare he, you know, how dare he take such a sober subject, you know, such a solemn subject and play it for laughs. But what, of course, what he was doing was showing us the absurdity of it, you know, the craziness of it. And that was the only way to get that across. And then we have the remarkable set, the War Room, designed by Ken Adam, who I mentioned, who later worked on Barry Lyndon, you know, one of the greatest sets in movie history.
Something I always remember about that movie, and it probably says something about Kubrick's storytelling ability, that, you know, when you're in the American bomber with Slim Pickens, like, you're, I don't know, you're almost rooting for these guys to pull through and accomplish their mission, and then, like, wait a minute, if they do that, everybody in the world dies.
Yes, that is that's great. And there's that great moment when George C. Scott is talking about how the plane is going to get through, and he's very excited by this, as if, you know, he's really rooting for them. Yeah, you're absolutely right.
Let's bring on another caller, and Tony is with us in Fenimore. Tony, hi.
Hi. Me being a veteran, I mean, just seeing Full Metal Jacket, I mean, the realism that he portrayed in that, I mean, just seeing the war zones and the training and everything, I mean, it was just so graphically real. I mean, you almost felt like you were there, you know. It was surreal, you know.
Tony, thank you so much for sharing that thought. David, Full Metal Jacket, I think based, you write, on memoirs of a veteran's experience from Vietnam. Talk about how Tony, a veteran, could have that, it's like you were there feeling.
Yeah, exactly. The movie was based on a book by Gus Hasford, who had been in Vietnam. It's a book called The Short Timers, which is now out of print, but quite a good book. And, you know, Hasford was quite a character. You know, I don't have time to get into his life, but, you know, very extravagant kind of roughneck type and, you know, but very funny and wickedly smart. And so Kubrick, along with Michael Herr, who had, you know, Herr was in combat as well and wrote one of the best books about Vietnam War called Dispatches. So they set out to make a movie, which again has an aspect of absurdity, just like Strangelove, that the scene at the beginning, you know, it's the great drill instructor, Sergeant Hartman, played by Lee Ermey, who had actually been a drill instructor. I mean, it's crazy, it's absurd, but as Tony was saying in his call, it also feels very real, you know, that kind of humiliation and that kind of training were actually did and does, I think, take place in the Marines. But also we have in the movie the sense of, you know, there's a certain shapelessness as we go on. The men get lost, you know, the squad doesn't know what to do next. And, you know, it mirrors the actual situation of America in Vietnam. It's like, why are we there? What are we doing there? Nobody really seems to know. And we have the main character, Joker, I'm not going to give away the ending of the movie, which is tremendous, so no spoilers, but, you know, he faces a crisis, a real test at the end, and you can see all the ambivalence in his face as he, you know, as he goes through the final moments of the movie.
We're revisiting our conversation with David Mikkix about the life and legacy of filmmaker Stanley Kubrick. He's the subject of Mikkix's latest biography, Stanley Kubrick, American Filmmaker. Coming up, we'll hear the rest of our conversation and talk about other Kubrick classics like Paths of Glory. That's coming up next here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're revisiting a conversation we had last December about the life and legacy of filmmaker Stanley Kubrick. Our guest was David Mikkix, Moore's Professor of Honors in English at the University of Houston. He's author of the biography Stanley Kubrick, American Filmmaker. We pick up our conversation from December with Peter from Milwaukee, who called in to talk about his favorite Kubrick film.
What a fascinating topic for one of the filmmakers that definitely occupies the top of Mount Olympus. I was curious, though, in your book, do you address the fact that Stanley Kubrick's vision, he did not want to compromise by having to work with the Hollywood studio system. And in order to absolutely execute his singular vision, which, his work is outstanding. But is it true that he did finance his own films in order to keep Hollywood from messing up his vision? And was there a specific instance that led him to that conclusion? Thank you.
Oh, great question. Thank you. Well, as I said, his first movie, his first feature was, you know, financed by a relative, his uncle. But as he went on, of course, he entered the Hollywood studio system. After Dr. Strangelove, which was such a massive hit, Kubrick really felt empowered to demand complete artistic control. In fact, he scribbled a note on a contract that was being offered to him by Columbia Pictures. And the note said that I demand complete, total, final, annihilating artistic control over the picture. So at any rate, that tells you something. But yeah, it was in part his experience on Spartacus. Now, this was his first big hit, Spartacus, which he took over from another director, Anthony Mann, at the request of Kirk Douglas, the star. The movie came out in 1960, but Kubrick had no control over the script. And he said, you know, I kept telling Kirk, this is dumb, the script, well, this has to be changed. And Kirk would agree with me and then nothing would get changed. And so Kubrick was very disappointed in that experience. So when he went on to make Lolita and then Dr. Strangelove, he did have complete control over those movies. Now, later in his career, it was really because his movies were made with relatively small crews and were relatively cheap that he was able to have such control. Warner Brothers executives, his final movies were all from Warner Brothers, from Clockwork Orange on. And the Warner Brothers executives, guys like John Calley and Terry Semel, were very happy to work with Kubrick. And of course, Kubrick worked at a very slow pace. You know, he did not turn out a movie every year or every other year. But, you know, what he did relatively inexpensively. And so they were happy to go along with it. They knew he was a genius. They knew he was a great director.
Thanks for that call, Peter. We'll go to Brian now in Ashland. Brian, hi.
Hi, Rob. So I became a pretty huge Kubrick fan when I was at the UW studying film. And later became a historian and find myself turning to his films to sort of supplement what we've been talking about. Some of the films you talked about, like Full Metal Jacket on Vietnam War, Dr. Strangelove on the absurdity of the Cold War. But one of the films that I seemed to show all the time for World War One was Paths of Glory, which I've not heard mentioned, but is one of his early films and one of the most, I would say, damning anti-war pictures ever made, which also stars Kirk Douglas and probably started their relationship.
Brian, thanks a lot for that call. Talk about, the lasting influence of Kubrick and how people could use him to illustrate not just film history, but history, David.
Yeah, well, Paths of Glory is a great instance. I mean, it's a very, although, you know, Kubrick actually made the trenches wider than they were, you know, so that the camera that he wanted could get through the trench. But by and large, it's a very accurate film, and it depicts a great scandal in French military history in which a group of generals decide to have some men executed for symbolic reasons.
I apologize for not being entirely honest with you. I apologize for not revealing my true feelings. I apologize, sir, for not telling you sooner that you're a degenerate, sadistic old man. And you can go to hell before I apologize to you now or ever again.
Colonel Dex, you're a disappointment to me. You have spoiled the keenness of your mind by wallowing in sentimentality. You really did want to save those men, and you were not angling for Miro's command. You're an idealist, and I pity you as I would the village idiot. We're fighting a war, Dax, a war that we've got to win. Those men didn't fight, sir. They were shot. You bring charges against General Miro, so I insist that he answer them. Wherein have I done wrong?
Because you don't know the answer to that question. I pity you.
So the movie was actually banned in France for decades. And, you know, despite Kirk Douglas's enthusiasm, Kubrick had a hard time getting a studio to take it on. It came out from United Artists. But the idea was that, well, you know, the French are going to ban it. And anyway, war movies are death at the box office. This is 1957, and there have been several big flops in the war movie genre just before that. But it is it does give you a remarkable feel for World War One combat when Douglas is crawling through no man's land, and there's a tremendous score by Gerald Fried, who was a high school buddy of Kubrick's. It's all percussion. And, you know, you see him, he's being filmed by a handheld camera, you know, just crawling slowly with these bombs bursting around him. And these are real explosions, too. It's not the usual shower of dirt that you get in a war movie. But Kubrick, Kubrick made sure that you get actual pieces of metal flying through the air. So, yeah, there's a lot of very precise obsessive detail that, adds to the historical accuracy in this instance.
Thanks a lot for that call. I'm going to end giving you a one-minute challenge. David, a friend of mine watched 2001, your favorite, recently, and said, you know, with our fast-paced entertainment now, it felt slow watching it. Make the case that we should retune ourselves to that pace and re-watch or watch for the first time 2001.
Oh, you should. You should so much. Well, you know, there's a challenge here, of course, because now not only during COVID, but even before that, we tend to watch movies at home. And 2001 especially seems to demand a big screen. You know, it's just sort of you get immersed in it. It surrounds you. It's a whole world. It's a whole universe. And, you know, if you're just sort of watching a bit and then making dinner and going back to it, you know, you lose that feeling. So I would say sit down, watch it. You know, if you have a big screen at home, that's perfect. And just give yourself over to it. Just surrender to it. Forget about time. My 10-year-old did it. My 10-year-old boy is actually a big fan of 2001. And so it can be done and it should be done. Yeah, I love it. The first really speculative movie made by Hollywood where you had to wonder, what does this all mean? What about that ending? And it was one of MGM's 10 biggest moneymakers, you know, a complete success.
That's a great place to leave it. David, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Rob.
That was David Mikics. He's the Morris Professor of Honors and English at the University of Houston. He's the author of several books. His latest is Stanley Kubrick, American Filmmaker. This was a rebroadcast of our conversation with David from last December.